Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of Ham Nation is brought to you by ICOM. For more information, visit ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation. By Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/HamNation. And by DX Engineering. DX Engineering offers practically everything you need to outfit your shack, plus the fastest shipping in the industry. In-stock items ship the same day, Monday through Friday until 10 p.m. Eastern. For more information, visit dxengineering.com/hamnation. This is Ham Nation, episode number 230, January 13th, 2016. Smith Charts, audio, and Heard Island, oh my.
Hello, everybody. It's K9EID, and we're getting ready to do Ham Nation. We're glad that you're here. This is show number 230. And boy, you got to have your pencils and everything else out tonight because we're going to have a lot of fun stuff and great education, because George is going to tell us all about, are going to start talking about Smith charts, and we're happy about that. Valerie's back. Don's been over learning more about the weather and stuff like that, but we'll check those just in a minute. But I'm really happy that I got things going here. I cannot tell you how many emails. It's just overwhelming, and I appreciate it. Keep them coming. Giving me ideas, asking questions, and we're going to answer some of them tonight. So we're here to help you. That's what Ham Nation is all about, is education of amateur radio, things that you just don't read. And if you do read, you don't understand. And so we're happy to be here with all of the information. George, you got a good one. How you doing down in Mississippi? We're glad that you're here.
I'm doing pretty well, Bob. It's been typical January in Mississippi here. The temperature is up one day and down the next, so we're kind of used to that by now. And we're going to talk a little bit about Smith charts tonight. We'll get into that after we've said hello to everybody. Basically, it's a deep subject, so we're going to have to start out with some basics, but good to be here tonight. Where is our buddy Gordo?
Gordo is out in the desert. He's out there with all those guys who are getting ready to do all of that. So we'll get a report back when he gets back from all that Quartz Fest stuff. But that's where he is. He's out trying to get ready for all that. I think he's probably there, knowing him. He loves all of that. So that's where he is, George.
Well, cool. I hope he took his Smith chart with him.
Might be beyond what they're doing in the desert, but that's all right. And Valerie is back. Hello, Valerie. We missed you. You had fun, I'm sure, but good to see you.
Yep, I just came back from a cruise where I didn't take a Smith chart, but I did take some suntan lotion. And it's now I'm back to the cold and to an empty house, just me, my dog, my Glock, and my shotgun. Waiting for Jerry to get back, Ira.
Well, I know he's having fun on Palmyra, though. You can talk about that in a little bit. I know you're gonna have Bob Schmieder with you. He's just really another one of the great de-expedition guys, and we'll get into that. I'm looking forward to that interview with Bob, and thanks for doing it. And Don, you were with Dr. Tamitha. How are things with her? How are you? You're cold, did you say?
Yeah, it is. It's cold here. It's 43, and it was like 28 the other day, and I figure I'm just getting over my cold. Today actually was the first time I was able to actually record commercials at work since New Year's. So, and I'm not completely back, but I'm close, and I figure, well, I'd wear the jacket because, A, it's cold, and, B, you know, I want to milk my little head cold for as long as I possibly can, and C, you know, I always like to give Ray Novak a cheap thrill, so... you know, right here. And I got to thinking about this whole, you know, we're in the midst of Powerball fever tonight, $1.5 billion. And they say your odds are greater of getting struck by lightning than winning the Powerball. Well, since I got struck by lightning already, I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm in with a bunch at work. So hopefully I'll be a little more well off next week. And if I'm not, well, oh, well. Here I am anyway. So we've got news tonight. No solar weather because Dr. T is in New Orleans. She addressed a meeting of the American Meteorological Society in New Orleans today talking about solar weather, which I thought was really cool. But, yeah, I had a great lunch with her and her husband, Kent, and their little six-year-old daughter, Evie. So just a great time and a sweetheart, and I'm so glad that I got to meet her. But we've got a big show tonight, and I say we just jump right in the middle of it, Bob.
We're going to do that, and going to start off by getting our learning caps on, and we're going to go down to Mississippi, and George is going to talk about Smith's charts. This is a very, very big part of amateur radio, and so much of it, especially to me, just goes over our head, and George is going to help us try to learn to understand it, and it's going to take a few shows, but George, let's see how we start with the Smith chart and why we need it.
Okay, Bob. Yeah, it is going to take a few shows to explain this. I've got one right here. Brian's got an actual photo of it that we can see right there. That is a Smith chart, and this is used a lot in dealing with antennas, transmission line, and matching. It's sort of like a nomogram or a slide rule or, you know, back before we had calculators, we used to have to plot stuff up or look it up on tables in one thing or another. That's when the Smith chart came about. It's a way to show the impedance of a feed line or an antenna or whatever you want to measure. There's a number of different things you can do with the Smith chart. And, Bob, I'm kind of with you. I have never really fooled with Smith charts much, and just I knew people had been asking about it in the chat room, and it was probably time that we covered it. And so I'm going to try to make it as painless as possible. Now, keep in mind, I'm learning as we go on this, too. After looking at it, I said, you know, I'm going to talk about this Smith chart and some of the things I'm going to plot on there. There's going to be some new people who don't know what those parameters are, and the Smith chart's going to kind of be meaningless to them if they don't understand what it is we're trying to plot on it and then display. So we're going to start out with some of the basics. Tonight, well, we're going to talk about Ohm's law and inductive reactants and capacitive reactants. And to do that, I've got some segments that we had done over a year ago on Ham Nation, and it covers some of those topics. Now, this is just some excerpts from some of these videos. On the bottom of the screen there, you'll see the actual episode number where you could go back, watch that episode, and get the whole story on each of these subjects. But we need to know all about resistance and reactance to deal with the Smith chart. We're also going to need to know a little more than that, but tonight that's where we're going to start. A little Ohm's law, a little inductive and capacitive reactance. What could go wrong?
Resistors are electrical components that restrict the flow of current. The unit of resistance is given the name ohm in honor of the physicist George Simon Ohm. Ohm is probably most famous for the law that bears his name, Ohm's law. Current equals voltage divided by resistance. The symbol of the ohm is the Greek letter omega. One way to explain resistance is with a water pipe. Think of the water pipe as a wire with no resistance. The water flows through it unimpeded. Now, let's add resistance by pinching the pipe in the middle. The water flow is reduced because it is restricted by the resistance. The value of several resistors connected in series is determined by adding their values together. I'm going to use the simple circuit simulator available at echalk.co.uk to illustrate how resistor combinations behave in circuits. The first circuit we're going to look at contains three 100-ohm resistors. To get their total resistance, we just add the three together, and that gives us 300 ohms. Now, if we applied 12 volts across these three resistors, we would use Ohm's law to find out that current equals voltage divided by resistance, or 12 divided by 300 is 0.04 amps, and that's 40 milliamps. Current is the same at all points within a series circuit, so we could insert an ammeter anywhere we wanted, and we'd always come up with 40 milliamps. Now let's try it with three different value resistors, 100, 200, and 400. We add those three together, and we've got 700 ohms of total resistance. So 12 volts divided by 700 ohms equals 0.0171 amps, or 17.1 milliamps. We already know that the current in this circuit will be the same no matter where we measure it. What about the voltage, though? We can determine the voltage across each resistor by using the formula volts equal resistance times current. So for the 100-ohm resistor, we've got 1.71 volts. For the 200-ohm resistor, we've got twice that much, 3.43 volts. And for the 400-ohm resistor, we've got twice again, or 6.86 volts. If we added all three of those voltages up, we would find out that it equals our source voltage of 12 volts. This is why series resistors are often referred to as a voltage divider network. Now let's look at parallel resistors, and we'll see that they behave quite differently. For just two resistors in parallel, we can determine the total resistance by multiplying the two resistors by each other and then dividing that number by the value of the two resistors added together. If we have more than two resistors, though, that formula won't work. In this case, we would take the reciprocal of each resistor value, which is 1 divided by the resistor value, and we would add all the values together. Then we would take the reciprocal of that number to get the total resistance. Let's take the three resistors that we were using earlier, a 100, a 200, and a 400, and connect them in parallel. If we measure the voltage in a parallel circuit, we will find that it's the same at all points. Using the formula we specified just a moment ago, we found out that the total resistance of these three in parallel is 57.142 ohms. Now, if we measure the current at each branch in this circuit, we'll find out it's a different story from the series circuit. The current flowing through each resistor will be determined by that resistor's value. Let's look at the 100-ohm resistor. Current equals voltage divided by resistance, so that would be 12 volts divided by 100 ohms would equal 0.12 amps, or 120 milliamps. Now, to find the total current for that circuit, there's a couple of different methods we could use. We could take our 12 volts for the circuit divided by the total resistance of 57.142 ohms, and that would give us 210 milliamps. Or we could just add up the value of the current for each branch circuit. As long as we're here, we might as well talk about power too, so that you get the right wattage of resistor for your circuit. There's two different formulas, and we can use either one since we already know the voltage, resistance, and current at all stages in this circuit. The first formula, power equals current squared times resistance, and the second formula is power equal current times voltage. We can apply those to each of our three resistor branches there, and we find out that as the value of the resistor goes down, the power goes up. When an AC voltage is applied across an inductor, the flow of current through it behaves very differently than that of a DC voltage. A sine wave produces a phase difference between the voltage and current waveforms. The opposition to AC current flow through a coil winding not only depends on the inductance of the coil, but also the frequency of the waveform. We could call this opposition AC resistance, but the more common name is impedance. The symbol for impedance is Z. Resistance is always associated with DC circuits, so to distinguish DC resistance from AC resistance, the term reactance is used. Just like resistance, the value of reactance is measured in ohms, but its symbol is X. Both capacitors and inductors have reactance. An inductor's electrical resistance, when used in an AC circuit, is called inductive reactance. Inductive reactance has a symbol of X sub L. In a purely capacitive circuit, the current leads the voltage by 90 degrees. Conversely, in a purely inductive AC circuit, the exact opposite is true. The current lags the applied voltage by 90 degrees. The formula for inductive reactance is X sub L equals 2 times pi times the frequency times the inductance. We can see that if either the frequency or inductance is increased, the overall inductive reactance value would also increase. As the frequency approaches infinity, the inductor's reactance would also be infinity, acting like an open circuit. Conversely, as the frequency approaches zero, or DC, the inductor's reactance would decrease to zero, acting like a short circuit. This means that the inductive reactance is proportional to frequency and is smaller at lower frequencies and larger at higher frequencies. Let's calculate the inductive reactance for an inductor of 100 millihenries and zero resistance across a 120 volt, 60 hertz power supply. We use the formula X sub L equals 2 pi FL, so that's 2 times pi, which is 3.14159, times 60 hertz times the inductance in henries, so that would be 0.1 henries, and we find that the inductive reactance is equal to 37.7 ohms. As a capacitor charges or discharges, a current flows through it that is restricted by the internal resistance of the capacitor. This internal resistance is known as capacitive reactance, and it has the symbol X sub C. Its unit of measurement is ohms. Resistors have more or less a fixed value and do not vary so much with frequency. However, capacitive reactance does vary with frequency. As the frequency applied to the capacitor is increased, its reactance decreases. And as the frequency decreases, the reactance increases. This is called complex impedance. And complex impedance exists because the electrons in the form of an electrical charge on the capacitor's plates pass from one plate to the other more rapidly as the frequency goes up. As the frequency increases, the capacitor passes more charge across the plates in the given time, resulting in a greater current flow. Let's look at the capacitive reactance formula. X sub C is the capacitive reactance in ohms, F is frequency in hertz, and C is capacitance in farads. So the formula is X sub C equal 1 over 2 pi FC. Let's try an example now using a frequency of 1,000 hertz and a capacitance of 1 microfarad. Now, 1 microfarad is 0.000001 farads. So, we would say 2 times pi, which is 3.142, times the frequency, 1,000, times the capacitance in farads, which would be 0.000001. And then we would divide that number into 1. And that would tell us that we've got 159.1343 ohms of capacitive reactance with this capacitor at 1,000 hertz. So we know a capacitor does not pass DC, and if we think about that, it makes sense because as you go down in frequency, the reactance goes up. So at DC, essentially the capacitor would have an infinite resistance. Normal resistors are not frequency dependent, and therefore current and voltage remain in phase. The illustration here shows current on the top graph and voltage on the bottom. Of course, capacitors take time to charge, and time is frequency. With a capacitor, voltage lags behind current because of the charging and discharging time.
Okay, now if you're still awake, there's a few things I want to point out about that. First, I wanted to cover that so that we would understand what resistance was and then what inductive and capacitive reactance were. They're kind of like resistance, but they deal with AC. So DC is easy stuff. Ohm's law, not very difficult. you should have a fair understanding of that, or be able to grasp it pretty easy. When you get into AC, things get a lot more complicated, as you saw there with reactants. Resistance is always an unsigned number, and it's measured in ohms. And it's pretty much the same whether it's an AC or a DC circuit. It does not change with frequency. Resistance would be constant at all frequencies if you're talking about AC. Reactants are the reactants of a component or of a circuit changes with frequency. And it's really only applicable to when you're dealing with AC circuits. Inductive reactance is measured as in positive ohms. Capacitive reactance is right the opposite, measured in negative ohms. So the combination of a pure resistance and then either this inductive or capacitive reactance is known as impedance when you combine the two together. And when we begin talking about antennas and how to plot that out on a Smith chart, you'll need to know that. You know, we're talking about a combination of pure resistance and reactance. And a lot of times, this will throw you for a loop right here. They'll call that pure resistance a real resistance. They'll call that reactance an imaginary value or imaginary resistance. When they say imaginary, they're talking about reactance. Not really sure why we use that term imaginary, but I'm sure someone does. But there you go. Just keep that in mind as we move forward. Now, when we pick back up next time, we're going to talk a little bit about impedance, the combination of everything we've talked about so far. And we're also going to have to cover SWR at some point. Once we've done that, then we're going to be able to talk a little more intelligently about that Smith chart and see some of the things that we can do with it. So there it is. Not much Smith chart tonight, but some of the legwork that we need to do to be able to understand what we're looking at when we actually get to one. Well, we'll be back in just a moment, but first let's get a message from ICOM.
Get into HF this winter season. Whether you're just starting out, a ham on the go, or an operator wanting to upgrade your shack, ICOM has a radio for you. Looking for that practical rig to get you communicating on the HF bands? The IC718 combines DSP technology in a compact size. It's durable and great for casual HF operating, and it's got easy-to-use and other attractive features not found in other entry-level radios. Want a solid HF radio and a small footprint? Consider the rugged, water-resistant IC7200. It's perfect to take on your next RV adventure, or set it up as an emergency station for your MCOM group. The 7200 offers simplified operation and features for voice, CW, and digital modes. Searching for that high-performing radio for everyday use? Try the IC7410. Casual and seasoned operators alike will love this HF radio. It builds upon ICOM's celebrated IC746 Pro. It includes faster DSP and built-in 15 kHz first IF filter, band scope, antenna tuner, and more. Does your shack need an update? How about the IC7100? You can use this mobile rig as a touchscreen base station. The separate operating controller is great for hams with limited shack space. You can even explore D-Star digital features, multi-band, and all-mode operation. Make sure you visit icomamerica.com/amateur for more information on ICOM's selection of HF radios.
And you can tune in and enter to win after each episode of Ham Nation. Go to icomamerica.com/hamnation and learn how you can win in the swag prizes, T-shirts, hats, but also the monthly grand prize drawing for a new radio. Go to icomamerica.com/hamnation for the official rules and to register. And you'll see there that this month they're going to be giving away an ICOM ID880H VHF UHF digital transceiver with switchable VHF UHF band. It's analog and D-Star, has wide band receive, free cloning software, and a lot more. So go to icomamerica.com/hamnation after this and each episode of Ham Nation and register to win. Sign up, good luck, and don't forget to follow ICOM America, Inc. on Facebook and Twitter. Now, I've got a couple of things that, well, we want to give away this week. You know, I asked a question last week, and when I asked this, I didn't know how the answers were going to turn out on it. But what I ask is, which former presidential candidate is a ham radio operator? And boy, we really got a lot of answers on that. We'll start out with some that I could not verify. I had one who said the answer was George McGovern. No, I couldn't find where George McGovern had ever been a ham. I had two that said Mitt Romney was a ham. I couldn't find anything to support that on the internet. I had three that said George Pataki was a ham, and his call sign was WB2AQC. I did find a ham with that call sign, but the photos I saw on the internet didn't look like the same dude. So I'm thinking, no, George Pataki, the presidential candidate, probably was not a ham. And the majority of people answered Barry Goldwater, K7UGA. And that's correct. Barry Goldwater is probably one of the best-known hams who ever held political office or who ran for president. However, that's still not exactly the answer I was looking for, because I was looking for someone who's still alive when I said the candidate is a ham radio operator. Well, I thought a few more of you would have got this one, but we only had one person who guessed this, and this is the answer I was looking for. And this came from John Hyatt, KC7DRI. And he said, Joe Walsh, WB6ACU. Walsh ran for president of the United States in 1980, promising to make Life's Been Good the new national anthem if he won. And he ran on the platform of free gas for everyone. I don't know how he didn't get elected with that. But anyway, it says, although Walsh was only 33 in 1980, he didn't meet the 35-year-old requirement to actually assume the office, but he said he wanted to raise public awareness of the election. Congratulations, John. You're going to win this Howl Sound t-shirt here. We'll be getting that out to you this week. One other interesting fact on Joe's political background there. Now, all this stuff's coming from the internet, so we know it's got to be true, right? Well, in 1972, Joe ran for vice president. This time his platform was free toilet paper for everyone. That's what I saw in one place. In another place, he said in 72, Walsh ran for vice president with Reverend Goat Carson under the slogan, "We want our money back." And, you know, how can you argue with that? So, there you go. Congratulations, John. You got who I was looking there. Joe Walsh, former presidential candidate. Of course, Barry Goldwater's the best-known one. So we'll be sending that out to you this week. But for next week, we've got another one here. That's this MFJ 113 Super Bright. You can't see it, can you? Large 24 and 12 hour alarm clock. Great clock there. Easy to see. I mean, you can set that across the shack there and you'll know what time it is.
Yay.
It's going to be easy to win this one, though. If you were paying attention, you know, we talked about Ohm's Law. Well, you know, for everything, you've also got something that's right the opposite. I want to know, what is exactly opposite of an ohm? And if you know the answer to that, well, send your answer to me, hamnationcontest@gmail.com, and you might win this MFJ clock. And now I'm going to bail out of here and sit back and learn a little bit about audio with Bob and the Audio Alley segment.
All right. That was really good. I got to tell you, that was great. And we'll look forward to learning more about the Smith chart. And before we get into some of the audio stuff, I want to brag a little bit on one of our audience, KD2IOG. You know, a few weeks ago, Randy had a segment on building a mixer. Remember the little mixer that we did years ago as one of the first projects that Heil Sound had on the market back in the mid-60s. And he did a really great job. I got to give him credit for what he did here. I hope you can see that. We have a new setup here. I hope that that you'll be able to see some of these pictures tonight. And he built this mixer, and he uses it for his HDs and his computer. And I said, yeah, we'll have to show that. There's the inside of it. Well, that was really great. I appreciate him sending that. So keep it up. He's going to work on his general class license, and we'll look forward to working him on the air. So we want to get started tonight answering some questions. A lot of guys are very, I think, confused about, I want to put a mixer in front of my radio, and should I, and all that. We talked a little bit about bandwidth last week, and bandwidth is very important. And we'll revisit this again in a few weeks just to remind you how important it is. We did a nice demo on the ICOM 7600. And you have switchable filters in most of the new radios. Unfortunately, a few of them roll off at 2.4K. Now, that doesn't say that you can't put a mixer on it and make it sound a little better. No, it's not going to be like the wide filter of the 76, 77, 7800, or the wide filter of the Kenwoods or Yaesus. But you still can enhance that, even with some of your tube rigs of 530s and some of the early tube radios. You can enhance that a bit. One that comes to mind is the IC735. That was a very early radio and has a real narrow filter. But I personally have gone in with a mixer and rolled off a little bit of mids and put in a little more bass, and it does help a little bit. So don't ever say it won't. But do you really need it? Are you going to gain a lot if you only have that filter? Because most of the rigs today have internal EQ, and you don't need to add all of that stuff. And when you are doing any equalization, do it a little at a time. That's one of the problems I hear a lot of guys that they will get an EQ, and you'll hear them playing with it, and they're going extreme. They're going here to there to there. How do they know what's going on? Don't do that. What you want to do is do it a little at a time, just a few decibels, and that really will let you hear what's going on with that particular parameter. So just a little at a time. I also like to record it in another receiver or perhaps your monitor. Some of the rigs have really good monitors, and record that. Then listen to it back and make a reference. I'm going to change this. I'm going to change that. That really helps you to hear it from another source. Like you're not talking. You're going to be listening to that person coming out of the speaker or the headphone. It's always best to do these tests with a headphone also, because it takes away the acoustics of the room and all that good stuff. And if you are going to put anything into your radio, you should be trying to do it through the line input. Most all of the rigs today have line inputs and line outputs. What are we talking about? Well, microphones are very weak. The signal is very weak, so you need a preamplifier. So here's a setup, and it goes through all of this where you can see the microphone input, the preamp. Then you can see the driver. As we go through this, the microphone preamp usually has sometimes 40 dB gain. Well, you can't take that mixer that's got it's got probably 100 dB gain. It's over a volt. You can put it in there, but if you do that, you're going to have to do some kind of a pad here. But the easiest way to do it is put it into the line input, and your radio has that in the accessory plug. And that's the best way to put a mixer into a radio, because you bypass all that front end and you don't overdrive it. Now, that's a perfect setup for the line input. If you're going to do the output, you know, we've talked a lot about this, where you really can help with putting a mixer on the output of any radio. And how you do that is come out of the line output. That comes right out of the product detector. And of course, you don't have to know all about that's inside the radio, but that's where it happens, right there. It comes out of the product detector into the volume control and then through the amplifier and the speaker of your radio. Bypass all of that. Come out of that product detector, line out. That's going to be an accessory plug in the back. Plug that into the input of your mixer. And again, it's going to be an input which is a line input. It's not going to be the microphone input. All of the controls will still work on it, but every one of these mixers, no matter which one, they all have a microphone input and they have a microphone output. Here is the input of the microphone. Balanced 3-pin. But there's also a phone jack. You cannot plug a microphone in there. Well, you can, but you're going to be about 30, 40 dB down. You don't want to do that. That line input is there to take a signal, like we just showed you, that's several volts maybe. That allows you to put big signals into here, and that bypasses that preamp that's in the mixer. You also have a gain control. And you can vary the gain of that preamp. And then you have all of these wonderful controls to change the equalization. And I got to tell you, it is a whole new world to be able to listen to any receiver when you're listening to it and being able to adjust the highs, the mids, the lows. And it's wonderful. The other situation is most of these mixers have pan pots because they're stereo mixers. They have a left output and they have a right output. You'll notice on this channel, it's all the way to the left. And what happens there? That only comes out of the left output, which is what you want to do when you're doing anything in amateur radio, because we're always mono. Now, if you put it in the center like that one, it's going to come out both left and right. And so play around with that. That's very important also. So you can go into the, if you have the JBL system, you're going to have two speakers. And those two speakers will allow you to have a left and a right. Now, you're not going to have the situation of stereo, no. But you take the pan pot, you put it in the left side, it's going to come out of the left output. If you put it to the right side, it's going to come out of the right side. For my amateur radio use, I always put it in the center, and it will drive both speakers equally. And then you can set the speakers up the way you need them, and so they're balanced acoustically. Incredible. And you just got to do this sometime. I mean, you won't ever go back to listening to any speaker. And to simplify putting things in a mixer into your transceiver, you could take one of our headphone adapters, which is, goes into the 8-pin input where your microphone or headphone normally would plug into. But if you plug the mixer in, you're going to overdrive it. Well, you can do a thing we call a T-pad. And a T-pad is, gosh, it's been around forever. We in the did this in 1976. It's become the Bible of the sound industry. The guy's still using it because there's stuff like this in here. And we show you how to build a T-pad. But most importantly, all of the resistors. Oh, this is so simple. You can do this easily. You do a little box, and here's what you got to do. You take three resistors, and it's what we call a T-pad. Just as it says, a T-pad. That one goes to ground. That is the input. That would be from your mixer. And this would be into the mic input. Now, we're saying mic input. This is a simple way to do this, and it works well. And it's one of those situations where when you do that, you can do it easily and not have to go through the back. This would be a 470 ohm. This one's about 220, and this one's around 120. And you can play around with those, but that will take that big signal coming out of that mixer into that real sensitive input, and it pads it down. It's called a T-pad, and all kinds of pads in our industry. But you can do that and make it real easy. Just get one of our headphone amps or adapters, and you probably already have one. You can plug it right into the front, and so that really works great. But experiment with your internal equalization, and do it in very small increments. And the other thing that's very important with every equalizer, now catch this, think about this. When you have an equalization form set up and you play with the mid-range, and if you back off the mid-range, it increases the highs. Your ears, playing games with your ears. And a lot of times when we get into the big systems in these arenas and stuff, it'll really throw you a curve, and it'll be the same thing here when you're either for your microphone or for your mixer for the output on to the JBLs. As you change the mid-range, it will also do something to the high end. And so they're all working together. And here's the way that works. This is very important. I'm very excited. I hope this new camera system works. I know it goes blank for a minute. But in closing here, it can't get any better than me trying to show you. I did these drawings last night. Here's the problem with trying to use like a Behringer mixer. And I had a question. I had several of them. And the guy said, well, how come you said it doesn't do good? Why would 10K not work? Understand, for amateur radio, we are dealing with usually about 100 cycles to 3K, sometimes a lot less. As I told you, some of these filters, those filters stop at 2.4. Well, now, wait a minute. Look at the equalizer in your Behringer or your little mixers. This one, usually they're about 12 dB. You see, this is the center line. Here's 12 dB, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, right? That's maximum. You're never going to do that, I wouldn't think. But you also can cut it 12 dB at 80 hertz. That's set by the engineer that built that mixer. Well, he also put one up at 10K because those mixers were made for recording and live. It wasn't made for ham radio. So what's happening here? What's happening is that's pretty much useless. Pretty much useless. So look for a mixer that has three-band EQ. Now we're getting somewhere because that usually the mids are 2.5. Boy, that's right at the beginning of the articulation value. That's where you want it. That's why our microphones always sound better, because we put a rise where the ears want to hear that mid-range, that so important mid-range. And if you roll it off, you got muddy, muddy, muddy. That's one of the key factors to the microphones we build, so we have articulate value and you don't have to do a lot. Plug it in and talk. But you see what happens here? Now that three bands are working good for you. You're only going to have two, but it sure makes a difference if that's what you're going to do. Now, you remember, we talk about, and we're going to get into this next week or week after when I'm back. We talk about parametric EQ. What in the world is parametric EQ? These are set by the design engineers, and you can't change it. That's what it is. Parametric, you can change the parameters. You can, if you want to move this up to, say, 200 cycles, you can actually change the frequency of that filter. Now, you still have the fact that you can bring it up to 12, sometimes 16 dB, and you also can change the bandwidth. You see, this bandwidth is set at an, you can see here, it's set at an octave. It's centered on 100, about 100 cycles, and it'll go all the way up to 200. That's an octave. Well, a third octave would only be that thin. So you see, you can change all of those parameters. You have three parameters. You can change the frequency. You can change the level, both boost and cut. And you can change the bandwidth of that filter. Just put a narrow little slice in something if you need. You can bring that 2.5K, bring it down to 1600 if you want. Bring that 12K down to 2. Now we're getting somewhere. See why parametric is so important? On the Elesis mixers that all of us or most of us are using here, the mids, only the mids are parametric. Oh, that works great. Because now we can move that down a little bit so it's in more in the region what we need. So I hope this helps you. Gosh, I know to a lot of people, man, this is so complicated. Just like George's Smith chart, it's so complicated. No, it isn't. And what's so great about Ham Nation, you can come back and watch all this stuff later and pay attention and write us. Tell us if we're way over your head, what you want to hear and see. I just hope this helps you. And we're going to be doing this here for a while. Now, I won't be here next week. I've got to go out to the NAMM show. It's our 50th anniversary of Heil Sound. We're so blessed and very, very humbled by this. And they got a big deal going out there, a big birthday party, I guess. And so we'll be out there. But when I get back, we'll be getting into this a little more. But look around at some of these EQs and I want to pay attention to Julius Jones, W2IHY. I'm going to get into his stuff. He's got an equalizer that's centered just for ham radio. It only goes to, I think, maybe 3,200 on the top end and 50 on the low end. Just what we need. And they're all octaves. And those are things that you want to look at. Yeah, the little Behringer's inexpensive, and there's a lot of them out there, not just Behringer. They've all, man, there must be 20 or 30 different little mixers. And they work, and they're cheap, and it gets you involved in it. But look around. There's some other things. But don't forget, you look at that transceiver. If you're looking to buy a new transceiver, you look at some of the transceivers. Almost all the new ICOMs have internal EQ, and they really work nicely. The couple of the Kenwoods have it. You also got to be careful. A lot of them are just, they're already set. Mid, high, low, that, me. That's okay, but you want something you can vary. So that's it, and I really appreciate having the time to try to take you through some of this stuff, and I hope that it's helping you. And I'm thrilled to get all of these emails. We're talking hundreds, and I usually get quite a few, but nothing like this. So we've really tapped onto something here, and I know you're going to have more knowledge here to watching Ham Nation with George's stuff and all the things we learned. Valerie's got a great interview coming up. You'll learn more about the DX side of things. And Don always keeps us up on news, and that's so important. Don, let's see what's going on in Newsline this week, and I'm glad to see you're feeling a little better.
From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 1993, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, January 13th, 2016. The new year finds Tintec with a new owner, again.
The assets of the company, founded in 1968, have been sold to Ohio-based Dishtronics, according to recent news reports. Although final details have yet to be disclosed, and neither company has formally announced the purchase, Dishtronics owner Stephen M. Dishop and 8WFF acknowledged the deal on the ARRL website. Dishop tells the ARRL that his vision for the business is, quote, strictly long-term, end quote. And he reaffirmed his 17-year-old company's commitment to its continued financial stability despite what he called, quote, some tough decisions, end quote. Toward that end, Dishtronics has contracted with former TenTech engineering manager John Henry, KI4JPL, and initiated new service policies and related pricing. Dishop said TenTech's service department had been operating at a loss. TenTech's asset sale is the latest for the beleaguered company, which began as the manufacturer of transceivers for QRP users. Last April, RKR Designs of Colorado announced it had purchased TenTech's assets along with those of Alpha Amplifiers from RF Concepts. The two lines had been merged less than a year earlier in yet another asset sale.
Skeeter Nash, N5ASH, reporting. Dishtronics has a variety of products in development and plans to introduce a new legal limit solid-state amplifier in May at the Dayton Hamvention. The well-publicized de-expedition of Polish amateur DOM 3Z9DX is still on, but you'll have to wait a little bit longer for it to happen.
DOM rocked the airwaves in late December with an unannounced on-air demonstration from North Korea, which was a big success, despite problematic solar conditions. Even with little fanfare announcing his presence, he managed to make almost 800 contacts, most of them in Asia. When he departed North Korea to celebrate the holidays back home in Poland, he announced a hoped-for return in February to get back on the air. His plans have since changed. He recently told DX World that he will now wait until late summer before launching his long-awaited de-expedition as P5. His goal, he says, is to find a location that will provide quieter operating conditions. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Graham Kemp, VK4BB.
So, good things come to those who wait. Your NOAA Weather Radio is about to get a new voice. Bobby Best, WX4ALA, picks up the story.
NOAA Weather Radio was about to deploy its first upgrade in 15 years of the system that produces its broadcast programs. And that upgrade will change the voice listeners hear delivering observations, warnings, watches, and forecasts. A number of Weather Service offices, including the ones in Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina, will be involved in an operational test and evaluation period following the launch this month. NOAA hopes the new voice, generated by a new computer system, weathers the flood of feedback it expects during this period, which is likely to last several months. If all goes well, the new system will have a nationwide rollout later in the year on all transmitters.
Don Siebert, N2MOO, Vice President of the Sierra Nevada Amateur Radio Society, was injured in a motor vehicle crash on New Year's Day and remains hospitalized in Reno, Nevada.
Reports on the Nevada Amateur Radio Newswire website indicate that Siebert's condition was being assessed by doctors following surgery. The report said the accident occurred after a woman turned into the path of his vehicle after failing to heed a traffic signal. Siebert had begun his third consecutive term as club vice president on the day the accident happened. Siebert is considered one of the principal architects creating the DMR system for the Sierra Nevada Club. According to the Sierra Nevada website, the former truck driver retired from his profession after being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. The website said that a GoFundMe account has been set up to defray his medical expenses following the accident.
Our best wishes for a speedy recovery. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news for over 37 years and counting at www.arnewsline.org. With Skeeter Nash, N5ASH, Graham Kemp, VK4BB, Bobby Best, WX4ALA, Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT at the news desk in New York, and our news team worldwide, I'm Don Wellbanks, AE5DW73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. Wow, that voice. Oh, my. I sound better, but still hurting a little bit. Let me show you something. You know what that is right there? That is audible.com on my iPhone. Audible.com, one of the sponsors of Ham Nation tonight, is a leading provider of audiobooks. They have more than 180,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, fiction, nonfiction, periodicals. And because you're a Ham Nation fan, Audible will give you a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out the services. Now, one book you might consider downloading is by a guy named Daniel Silva, and it's The Messenger. This is one of those. I told you about this last time we had Audible on. It's a spy
a spy book, and the main character is Gabriel Alon. He's an Israeli spy. And so a quick synopsis of the book: when the laptop of a terrorist mastermind falls into the possession of the office, which is the people that Alon works for, the suspect, Gabriel, suspects an imminent attack on the Pope. Well, there is an attack on the Vatican. The Pope ignores Gabriel's suggestion that a large outdoor ceremony be moved to an enclosed, more secure structure. Suicide bombers caused more than 700 deaths among worshipers. The Pope is rescued just as more terrorists arrive to shoot missiles at the Basilica. Anyway, Gabriel Alon joins a member of the CIA in a secret scheme to infiltrate a vast network of this terrorism financier named Zizi. He's linked to the bombing. Now, Zizi is a huge art collector, and Gabriel Alon is also an art restorer, one of the best in the world. Well, they kind of meld those two together. It's the spy world and the art world. They find an undiscovered Van Gogh that they sell to Zizi, and by doing that, they infiltrate his organization. And, well, you'll just have to read the book or listen to the book for the rest of it. But there are 12 or 13 or 14 of these Gabriel Alon books that Daniel Silva wrote, and I'm on two of them. Actually, I've read three. That's the second one that I read, and it's just fascinating. I love that kind of stuff. So if you would like to check out The Messenger by Daniel Silva or any other book that you want to download for free, go to audiblepodcast.com/hamnation, audiblepodcast.com/hamnation. It is good stuff, and we thank Audible for being a sponsor here of Ham Nation. I think you're going to like it. If you got a long commute like I do, you're absolutely going to like it. Val, how are you tonight? What's the word on P5? Do we know from Dom? Do you have any update on that?
No, I don't. It looks like it's a legitimate, that he was there legitimately the 20th through the 21st, although I can't confirm or deny either way. I know rumors going around that he wasn't there. He was in China then. But if you do go to Club Log, I've put in some call signs of people I know that worked him, and it is valid on Club Log. I'm going to try and get Dom on here in 2 weeks. So we'll see if I can get him on the air, and we can get him to confirm or deny that he was at P5 December 21st and the 20th. And it looks like he made about 780 Qs. So hopefully those are good. But no, I don't have any definite information at this time. So hopefully I'll get that for you in the future. But I hope everybody had a great Christmas and New Year's. I know it's been a while since I've been on the air, but hopefully it was worth the wait because I have a really great guest tonight. He is very accomplished. He holds the extra class license, Kilo Kilo 6, Echo Kilo. He not only has his PhD in physics from Columbia, he was inducted into the Amateur Radio Hall of Fame back in 2011. He has been on several de-expeditions and expeditions, either for research or for amateur radio. He's usually led or co-led them, many of which received de-expedition of the year. He's also wrote several books, including a children's book called Great Adventures, which might be a great idea to get your grandkids interested in the de-exing aspect of the hobby. I'm talking about Bob Schmieder, KK6 Echo Kilo. Oh, welcome aboard, Bob.
Well, thank you very much, Valerie. Very nice to see you.
And thanks for taking time out of your schedule. I know you're missing your grandson's 7th birthday party, and I want to wish him a happy birthday and thank him for letting him share you with us tonight. Now, I know you've got the big de-expedition coming up to Heard Island, and that's going to be in March and April to VK0 Echo Kilo, Heard Island. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But first, I want to ask you, how did you get interested in amateur radio?
I think my interest in science and technical things started when I was about 13 years old or so. A neighbor person was doing electronics in his garage, and I happened in there, and from then on I was absolutely stuck. My first license was while I was an undergraduate, and then eventually I upgraded and started getting involved in DXing rather seriously. That was quite a few years later because I had a career to build first, but the start was all due to the credit of my neighbor.
Oh, very good. Now, I know you've been on a lot of expeditions and de-expeditions, and I do have a couple of slides if you want to show 7 and 8, Brian. And while he's showing that, maybe you can talk a little bit about some of these de-expeditions, if you've had any kind of close calls or any memorable events that happened on these de-expeditions.
Well, of course, there have been a lot of memorable events. The first really big expedition was to Peter 1 in 1994. There's been a subsequent Peter 1 expedition, but that one was just an astonishing adventure. We were taken there by a Russian icebreaker, helicoptered on by Russian helicopters. That's an adventure. We were there for 3 weeks. We were the first group ever to be left alone on Peter 1. And the first group in history to be left without an offshore support ship, because three weeks later, a different Russian icebreaker came and picked us up. In the middle of that, the Germans went by and flew onto the island with a helicopter, and they jumped out of their helicopter and they said, could we use your bathroom, please? So we did that. They didn't want to stay for lunch, but there's been quite a few adventures that are amusing or rewarding or almost any kind of adjective you'd like to attach to them. It's been a lot of really amazing adventures.
And if you show that slide, I see you've been to Heard Island before, back in 1993, and now you're going again coming up this March. So obviously nothing scary or no close calls on that last one. So how long have you been planning this new one to VK0?
Oh, I would say 20 years since the previous expedition. Yeah, it was VK0IR in 1997. The Australian government regulates visits to Heard Island, which is an Australian territory. And as a result of that regulation, you can't just go there as an adventurer and wander around and do whatever you might feel like doing. These visits to Heard Island are extremely planned in extreme detail. For our 1997 project, we had absolutely not one single problem. We didn't lose a single suitcase, have a single case of serious illness, and so on. When I was there in 97, I just absolutely became addicted with this island. It's the most astonishing place I've ever been. Of all of the places I've been, I have routinely said the only place I would go back to is Heard Island. So 3 years ago, I made the decision to go back again. This time, we're going to not only do amateur radio as VK0EK, but also a fairly ambitious scientific set of projects. And we hope and expect to come back with some really interesting scientific results, including probably some new species of plants and animals.
So how are you getting there? I think you're sharing the Braveheart, is that right? Because they're right now doing the VP8 de-expedition, is that correct?
Well, the sharing is right because we share the crew, but not overlapping in time. VP8 group is on their way right now to South Georgia, and we certainly wish them luck. When they complete that, they'll come back to Stanley in the Falklands. They'll then move the boat up to Cape Town, South Africa, and that's where we will meet them first week of March. And so then the Braveheart will take us to Heard Island. When we finish there after 3 weeks, we'll go on to Fremantle, Western Australia, rather than back to Cape Town. Because it's sort of on the way home for the Braveheart. So that's our basic itinerary.
So how long of a boat ride is it to from the Falklands to Heard and then from Heard to Fremantle?
Well, as you can imagine, it's going to depend on the weather. You know, if you get high seas, you have to slow down. So nominally 10 days, say, from Cape Town to Heard Island, 3 weeks on Heard Island, nominally another 10 days to Fremantle. But if we get into high seas, it could take more days. That's why we call it an expedition, not a tour, because on an expedition, you can't predict and control absolutely everything. There are some unknowns. I have been there. I've seen those seas, and they they are about the worst seas in the world. People agree on that. So we are hoping for the best, and we'll accept anybody's good wishes, hopes, and prayers for calm seas and fair winds.
Now, I know last time you went there, that was in January. Is that correct? And this time you're going to be going a little later in the season. Is it a little more dangerous because of that?
Slightly so, but the weather is not all that different. The temperature on Heard Island is always about 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees. I'm sorry, get rid of this phone call here. Just a few degrees above freezing. So the weather itself is not all that different. And I think in March and April, the sea state should be workable. It will be windier, and therefore the sea will be rougher than in January, February. But the reason, of course, that we're going in March and April is because the VP8 group is going in January, February. It's their turn right now. We'll have our turn in a month and a half or so.
And how many operators are you bringing?
We have 14. That's fewer than
we had. And you got a couple doctors and things like that?
Oh, we have one doctor. One doctor. And ironically, the doctor is the same doctor or one of the doctors on the VP8 group. So that's Arliss. And so he will ride the boat from the Falklands up to Cape Town and meet us. And then we'll go out there. So, but we're happy to have him as our expedition doctor.
I have multiple camps on Heard Island, or just one camp?
We're prepared to do several. The main camp will be at Atlas Cove, which is the main visitor area. If you take a tourist vessel to Heard Island, they will probably land you at Atlas Cove on the northwest side. And we will set up our camp. We have two very large shelters and some other smaller ones. But then we also expect to set up a camp at the opposite side of the island. It's 20 miles away at Spit Bay, a place called Spit Bay. Part of the reason for that is that the propagation path to the Central North America and West North America is very poor from Atlas Cove. There's a volcano in the way, a 9,000-foot volcano in the way. So we decided to do at least part of our operation from Spit Bay, the other side of the island, so that we'll have a straight shot towards Central and Western North America. The other part of the reason for going there is that scientifically, it's extremely interesting. A lot of very active, dynamic glacial processes, lagoons. There's a whole huge lagoon a mile across that's formed in the past 10 years. We have identified streams that disappear into the ground, other streams that just emerge right out of a hole in the rock, and so on. So geologically and biologically, it's a very interesting area and worth going to this opposite side of the island, even if there weren't a radio reason, but there is. There's two reasons to go there.
Now, what kind of antennas are you going to have? Are you going to have verticals or a lot of wires?
Well, we'll have, for the low bands, we'll have four squares. They're very effective, very efficient. We used those in 1997. And then we'll have some Yagis for the mid bands, like 20, 15 meters. Now, we're not going to get any 6-meter contacts. There's no propagation for that. But the combination of the four square verticals, which will be right on, not so much on the beach, but it's a floodplain that gets flooded by seawater. So those antennas are extremely efficient. We used them on Clipperton in 2013. They were extremely effective. They can be steered somewhat by phasing. And then the Yagis, of course, are steered by turning them. So I think we'll be able to cover all the bands up through about 15 meters, 10 meters, 12 meters, but no 6 meters.
Yeah. Well, It sounds good. Are you going to have all bands, all mode at both camps, or mostly at the main camp and just some of the bands on the secondary camp?
What we want to do, our goal really is to work as many different DXers as possible, and specifically try and give a little favor to the people who don't have any contact with Heard Island at all. So what we plan to do is to sort of concentrate on the, shall we call them money bands, 20 meters, 15, 40 meters, concentrate on those a little more upfront. That is initially, say, the first week. And then as we get a feeling that we are succeeding with giving people all-time new ones, branch out into the other bands. For the operation from Spit Bay, we're limited in the amount of equipment we can take, and so we're not able to set up the full set of antennas that we'll have at Atlas Cove. And another reason for that is that the terrain there is extremely rough. It's hilly, it's rocky. We just could not set up the same kind of antennas. So for Spit Bay, we will also concentrate on the money bands, probably 40, 20, 15, and so on. But overall, we expect to activate all bands, all modes within those constraints.
And the final question, how much is this de-expedition costing? I know they're getting so expensive nowadays.
They're getting expensive. A good part of the reason is because of the transportation. We were able to do it in 1997 for only $10,000 per person. And that was because we had transportation on a ship that normally goes to Kerguelen, which is very close to Heard Island. So they just took us there. But that transportation was not available. So we had to charter a vessel. We've gone through several vessels. The charters turned out to be unsatisfactory, and finally connected with the Braveheart, which turns out to be not only satisfactory, but wonderful for many reasons. The total cost for the whole expedition is somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000, call it $450,000 or so. The contribution for each team member is $18,000. And we've been able to raise the rest. We've had sponsorship. About two-thirds is from the radio community, and thank you all very much for that, including the major foundations. And one-third from scientific sources or sources that are supporting scientific work as well as the radio. So, for instance, the shelters that we're going to use are worth about $50,000, and they were provided at no cost. And satellite coverage, connections, terminals is provided with unlimited airtime at no cost to us. So all those sponsorships really help to reduce the amount of cash that we had to raise and then spend. But the total budget is about $450,000.
Plus, you probably had a lot of equipment sponsors as well, which is always nice.
Yeah, I sort of included that. The radios are being provided, Elecraft, antennas, a lot of the gear. We had some left over from previous expeditions. Not as much as you might think, because gear and equipment gets damaged, and you don't want to you don't want to take old dirty stuff if you don't have to. You want to take new stuff, and by and large we have. But we certainly have had a lot of sponsors for equipment in the radio area, and boy, do we appreciate that. Couldn't do it without those sponsors.
Very good. Now, do you have you met all your needs financially, or what can people do if they want to help donate? I know we have, if they go to the website, I think I have a slide on that, slide 10, Brian. And I think on the far right, they can click donate if they want to help out. If you go to heardisland.org, and then on the far right is a donate button, and they can donate now. Now's when you need it, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's our homepage, and it's actually on the link is on the bottom there, and it says donate. It's in the lower right-hand corner. That's right. That's the page that you see. And like to point out that, first of all, the website is heardisland.org. All donations are tax deductible. We're a 501c3. All the information is there on the website, but if you want more, I can provide it. We will continue to appreciate the donations. We've been successful enough so that we are not in risk of not going. We can pay the bills. The only question is, can we pay all of the bills? There are some expenses that are unknown, port fees, customs fees. Many organizations have a contingency in case things unpredicted happen. And they might. So we will appreciate very much the continued donations. PayPal is the easiest way to do it. That they take about a 3-4% cut, but that's not so bad. Love to have it. And there are various categories. If you donate $30 or $100, you get to be in one category or another. I'll just remark on one. If you donate $100 or more, you can be in a category called You Name It. And the reason is we are almost certainly going to collect some new species that are new to science. And any of those people on that list will be able to suggest a name. Can't guarantee it, but you could suggest a name for it. Name it after yourself if you wish, or your lady friend or your man friend or whatever. By all means, we will appreciate all of those, all that support.
Now, before I let you go, I just want to find out if, say, Bob or Don or George or if anybody else out there has any questions for you, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Heil, George, Don, anybody?
I'm good. Nope. I'm good. I'm looking forward to, okay, to trying to work this. So,
Yeah,
it sounds like they're going to be loud with some beams. So that's really good on the money bands. Well, I'm going to let you go, Bob. Yep. I know you gave up a lot to be here tonight, and I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll get you back after the de-expedition. You have some really good pictures and some good stories to go with it, right?
Well, I not only hope so, but I'm sure we'll have lots of pictures. Of course, we're going to have thousands and thousands of pictures. I hope we'll have lots of good stories. Mostly, I hope we'll have lots of DXers in our log. So we're looking forward to that. It's going to be a fun time for us. And then it's going to be fun meeting people at the conventions, Visalia, Dayton, and Friedrichshafen, and so on afterwards. So thank you again for your support and for this opportunity. And look forward to interacting with you next time.
All right. Hey, sounds good. Have a safe and good de-expedition. Oh, you have a question, Bob?
Yep.
Yeah, I just want to tell you publicly, Bob, I really appreciate all you do, because I know this takes a ton of time and money. A lot of guys wouldn't understand. It is overwhelming, and I know that through the years we've helped you with the headsets and connectors and cables, and should you need help here, you know where I am. So give me a buzz, but congratulations on getting it all going, and I look forward to helping you along the way, and thanks for being here tonight.
Well, thank you, Bob. I've enjoyed seeing you at the conventions year after year, and appreciated having your support year after year. We'll look forward to that. Thank you for your good wishes, we'll look forward to seeing you and the others on the other side. By the way, if you're going to Visalia, I think. We are planning a rather special program. You know, we're going to give the after dinner talk at the banquet. And I think we're going to have a live satellite feed to that banquet, which will be a bit of an experiment, but it'll be fun. So if you or any of the others are going to be there, I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope it'll be successful and hope you'll enjoy that.
Well, I hope I go this year, and hopefully there'll be no albatrosses in your slides.
No albatrosses. I love
that. Do you remember that one? Anyway, all right. Well, thanks a lot, Bob. Okay. Have a great trip, and hopefully you get a lot of uniques in the log, and hopefully I'm one of them. So take care, and have safe travels to you and your team.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, as far as DXing goes, I'm going to kind of breeze through this. I had a lot more, but I know we're over on time here. But as you know, right now, if you want to show DX1, Brian, K5 Palmyra is going on right now. Jerry's there. And that's going on. They just came on the air yesterday, and they're going to be there through the 25th. They're really weak here. I'm having trouble, and I have a nice antenna farm. If you go to Palmyra2016.org and you click on the propagation button, you can see when the best propagation is for each band at each UTC hour, so you can help determine when the best time is to work them on what band you need them on. I still have yet to get them in the log, but hopefully it's only day one. I'll be out in the wee hours of the night doing 40 and 80 trying to get them tonight. The VP8 guys, they just landed in South Georgia. Now, that's the more pleasant of the two islands. They're going to South Georgia and South Sandwich Islands. So they landed in South Georgia. They have to, there's a small contingent of researchers on the island, and they have to sit through an informational and safety class before they can continue on to South Sandwich. So hopefully tomorrow they're going to continue on to South Sandwich after doing their informational thing. And they hope to be on the air from South Sandwich, which will be VP8 Sierra Tango, Italy. And that'll be from the 17th through the 25th, weather permitting. Now, that's the rougher landing. A lot of boulders and waves. I watched some videos on that, and it looks to be a rough landing there. So they hope to be on the air for 8 days. Then they have to pack it all up, get back on the Braveheart, and head back to South Georgia. And there they're going to operate for 8 days from February 1st through the 9th. And that call sign is going to be Victor Papa 8 Sierra Gulf, Italy. So make sure you get those guys in the log, too. That's Very Rare DX. As far as contesting goes, this weekend is the NAQP sideband contest. And that's Slide 5, Brian DX 5. And that's this Saturday, 1800 UTC, which is noon my time. And it goes till midnight my time. Whoop, nope, the other one. And there's two categories. You can have low power, which watt less, or QRP, 5 watts or less. And you know what? I think I'm going to try QRP this weekend with this antenna farm and the YL voice. Maybe I can make some good QSOs with QRP. So if you hear some YL down in the weeds, that'll probably be me. This is where you work all 50 states and all 13 provinces. Those are all your multipliers. Now, Washington, D.C. counts as Maryland. You can work non-North American countries. They're going to count for QSO credit, just not as a multiplier. And your exchange is going to be your name and your state. So if you have a really long name like Quinn Thremnigan, you might want to shorten it down to Quinn. I'm going to be Val. And you're going to hear a lot of Al's and Bob's on the air this weekend, so get ready. And if you work somebody who's from outside of North America, you just need their name. So hopefully we'll hear you on the air, and hopefully you'll hear me, especially being QRP. So that's all I've got for the DX and contest report this week. I'll see you guys in 2 weeks, and I'm going to pass it over to Don back in Mississippi, and he's going to tell us all about DX engineering.
Awesome stuff, Val. Thanks. Yeah, we are running way late, so let's get into this so we can see if we can get into the chat room tonight. You know, last fall, DX Engineering announced that Yaesu is now one of the product lines that's being carried. Well, now DX Engineering is celebrating because in 10 days, January 23rd, DX Engineering will have their Yaesu Day from the showroom right outside of Akron, Ohio. Now, what's the big deal about Yaesu Day at DX Engineering? Well, everything at DX Engineering is a big deal. You can talk directly with the Yaesu sales teams. Check out the latest radios in the Yaesu line. The DX Engineering technical staff will be there from 9 to 2 to answer your questions and offer advice. They'll be giving free station consultations. So if you've got something that's been bugging you, stop on by. Now, they can probably help you with it. Of course, a fully functioning Yaesu station and repeater you'll be able to use, too. The N8DXE repeater is always on the air. You can find that frequency easily at dxengineering.com. And you can take advantage of some huge discounts on open box DX Engineering gear. The deals will be available while they last and continue both Saturday and Sunday, the 23rd and the 24th. Now, most deals on Yaesu Day will be revealed at dxengineering.com, so you want to check back often for updates on that. Yaesu Day is a great chance to get out and mingle with fellow hams, make some eyeball QSOs, and, of course, the VP8 South Sandwich and South Georgia Island. The expedition is coming up soon, as Val detailed there. They're listed as number 3 on the most wanted list, so don't miss your chance to snag these super rare contacts. They're a must if you're chasing honor roll status. And the DX Engineering met with the VP8 team to develop station setups, and that will make sure that VP8 is a success. You want to show what the VP8 team will bring to the islands. There is a DX Engineering developed VP8 DXpedition combo, a series of them. There are four in total. They're a great resource for any operator planning their own DXpedition. You can use them to benchmark your home station. DX Engineering, of course, heavily involved with several of the other high-profile DXpeditions on the 2016 calendar. And full details as we get closer to their respective on-air dates, you can find it all there. K5P Palmyra Atoll just wrapped up, or actually is going now, so there's a new combo for that DXpedition as well. And, of course, you know this. I don't have to tell you, but I will anyway because, you know, I'm that kind of guy. DX Engineering will ship faster than anybody else in the industry. If you get your ground shipping order in by 10 o'clock tonight, Eastern, Monday through Friday, not just tonight, but Monday through Friday, if it's in stock, it'll be on a truck headed your way that night. Proven products, expert advice, DX Engineering will help you shrink the globe. Your catalog is available, or you can shop online 24/7, dxengineering.com/hamnation. dxengineering.com/hamnation. Great supporters of what we do here at Ham Nation. And now let's see if we have some chat room stuff with Amanda. How are you tonight, darling?
I'm doing good. Go Broncos in the playoffs.
There you go. Yeah, since my Saints are out, why not? Go Broncos.
Yeah, thank you. And Val, go Green Bay. I'll root for them for now. Anyhow, Val, I've got some questions for you for sure. The first one I just wanted to go over, since it's now DXpedition season, I'd love to remind people of how to try to work a DXpedition station. So I would first, and you chime in after this, but I would first love to remind everyone, they're most likely working split. Stop calling on top of them. Val, you take it from there.
Definitely. They're almost always working split unless you hear otherwise. And please don't tune up on the DX frequency. Some of us are really struggling to hear that DX frequency, and that just drowns them off. Use the DX code of conduct. You can just go. I have it on my QRZ page. If you go to NV9L, I have a DX code of conduct logo. If you click on it, it takes you right to the link. And so please follow the DX code of conduct. And always make sure your split button's on and tune up into a dummy load or on another frequency, please. Those are my three main things.
Absolutely. And I've been listening. I've been trying to listen to K5P, not a peep yet. I still have it on 20 meters right here. I was hoping maybe, just maybe, propagation would open up, but not so much yet. Anyhow, thanks, Val, for that. Couple other things. You had mentioned Club Log, and I think that that's a great resource now. So obviously you belong to it. Now, why should everyone else join up and belong to Club Log and submit their logs there?
Well, it's what I use it for. I put it on there. A lot of people now, they don't have to send me cards. They can request my card through Club Log. You can set it up for free, which I did. I'll send it to them for free through the Bureau. But I use it to OQRS a lot of the DX I need rather than mail them a card. If you OQRS, it's usually the same price you would have spent to send them a card. So I go on there a lot and use that for most of the DXpeditions. Also, a lot of the DXpeditions have really good propagation charts on there too as well. So it's just got a lot of useful things to use it. And I just like having my log in the cloud just in case I need to access it. I can access it from my phone very easily. If I meet somebody, I can just pull it up on Club Log and see if I worked them. So
absolutely. And I didn't really even think a lot about Club Log, but there's also a couple other cool features about it. If you've ever gone to somebody's QRZ page, you can see it kind of streaming there and showing all their contacts recently. So that's kind of a cool thing. You can kind of see where they're open to. And the other thing is you can find out if you've actually been logged in with the DX station that you've been trying and you thought that you made a contact with. Now you can double check after they've uploaded it. So I think those are also cool advantages for, I don't think you have to be a member to do that stuff. I think you can just search, but it's kind of cool stuff. Other than that, along with working the split, Val, there's kind of some speculation in the chat room that some of these DXpeditions aren't being fair because they're working in the extra portion of the band. But when they're working split, they're actually talking in the extra portion and listening up in the general. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on where in the de-expedition they're at. Most wanted de-expeditions start out in the listening and transmitting in the extra clash portion. And the reason for that is the pileups are so massive, that's just one way to thin the herd, so to speak. And that usually happens in week one. And then in week two, they may be transmitting in the extra class or advanced portion, but listening up in the general portion and opening it up to others. When they first start off, it's just so hard to even pick out one letter of a call sign sometimes. So, and they don't want to be listening 5 to 30 up, you know, and taking up so much band use. So that's just one way they can thin the herd, is by not letting the generals work them that first week, but watch the within usually after week one, they're going to be open to everybody. So they'll be in the bands. Everybody can work them on. Every general can work them on. So that's why they do that.
Very good. Well, thank you for that info. That helps a lot to know what to expect. So, and I can't wait for Jerry to get back. Maybe he'll tell us all about it. And I can't believe he went to a really warm, nice place this time. So congrats for him. I hope he's having fun. With that, Don, this question was originally for Bob, but I think that you can probably answer it. Again, speculation in the chat room was that if you're going to throw a mixer into your HF setup, it usually tends to make you wider than the regulation of 2.4 to 3.0 kilohertz. Is that true? Is that what mixers do, or is that really not the cause?
No, that's like that's a pretty blanket statement. How wide you are depends on how you adjust the mixer.
I mean, okay.
That's totally on the user. Completely and totally on the user. You can stay within 3K very easily, and probably if you're going over 3K anyway, it may be because you're compressing too much and you're too loud and you're just splattering out. But that's where it comes into listening in headphones and using. If all you have is a monitor on your radio, that's not the best, but it's better than nothing. Listen to yourself in headphones as you transmit on the monitor. Listen to yourself on another receiver. And if you don't have another receiver or can't borrow one, get on one of the SDR receivers and pick a location where you know you have propagation into and listen to yourself coming back. That will give you a really good indication of how you're going to sound from a decent distance away. So, it's all on the operator. It's all on the operator at that point, I think.
Good. Well, and I see now that I have this 7600, which I love with the new waterfall addition to it, you can absolutely see when people are totally splattering the band.
Right. Yeah.
And it almost, it gets you. It kind of irritates you. But, you know, you're not sure if they're going to listen to you if you try to explain that they're kind of splattering. And I wish everyone would take the time to listen to their signal or ask somebody that they know, listen for me. Tell me what you hear. Is it wide? And what am I doing? Is this a good signal? It's not hard to ask for those signal checks and hope that people are honest with you. So,
yeah.
Hey, you guys, that's all I have. Great interview, Val. Wonderful. And kudos to you, to all your pals out there on, Palmyra Island? No, I'm going to mess it up. Sorry. Palmyra Atoll, right, Val?
Yeah, Palmyra. I used to live near Palmyra, Wisconsin. I was thinking of taking a road trip up there so I could work Palmyra from Palmyra. But I can't even hear him from this massive antenna farm. So it's a struggle to get those guys.
It is right now. Hopefully, maybe they'll go to 40 meters. Maybe we'll have better luck or something. But I'm sure they're busy as it is. So that's all. That's all I've got, you guys. Have a great night. Over to you, Don. I'm sure you're wrapping it up here for us.
All right. Yeah, but Bob is probably still here, but we'll tell you where the nets are. 7278 is where Steve, W7UDI, and the folks are on 40. And Echo Link, Star Deuterop in Star, 355-800 on D-Star. And, of course, 14 Charlie... rather, that's on Echolink and 14 Charlie on D-Star. So get out and have fun with the nets. We've had a show and a half tonight, according to the clock. Bob, you want to wrap it up for us?
Bob
is
gone.
Dr. Bob has left the building. So I'll do it. We'll say for everybody, for Val and George and everybody else along with Ham Nation. Thank you so much for watching. We appreciate you so much. And we'll see you next week right here on Twitter on Wednesday night. So 7-3, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.